as lost, adrift in a life without ultimate meaning. Their predicament is summarized in an insurance advertisement of 1997. The year is 1999. You are dead. What do you do now? They enter established religions, succumb to cults, dabble in New Age nostrums. They push the Celestine Prophecy and other junk attempts at enlightenment onto the bestseller lists. Perhaps, as I believe, it can all eventually be explained as brain circuitry and deep genetic history. But this is not a subject that even the most hardened empiricist should presume to trivialize. The idea of the mystical union is an authentic part of the human spirit. It has occupied humanity for millennia, and it raises questions of utmost seriousness for transcendentalists and scientists alike. What road, we ask, was traveled? What destination reached by the mystics of history? No one has described the true journey with greater clarity than the great Spanish mystic Saint Teresa of Avila, who, in her 1563-1565 memoir, describes the steps she took to attain divine union by means of prayer. At the beginning of the narrative, she moves beyond ordinary prayers of devotion and supplication to the second level, the prayer of the quiet. There, her mind gathers its faculties inward in order to give a simple consent to become the prisoner of God. A deep sense of consolation and peace descends upon her when the Lord supplies the water of grand blessings and graces. Her mind then ceases to care for earthly things. In the third state of prayer, the saint's spirit, drunk with love, is concerned only with thoughts of God, who controls and animates it. O my King, seeing that I am now, while writing this, still under the power of this heavenly madness, grant, I beseech thee, that all those with whom I may have to converse may become mad through thy love, or let me converse with none, or order it that I may have nothing to do in the world, or take me away from it. In the fourth state of prayer, Saint Teresa of Avila attains the mystical union. There is no sense of anything, only fruition. The senses are all occupied in this function in such a way that not one of them is at liberty. The soul, while thus seeking after God, is conscious with a joy excessive and sweet that it is, as it were, utterly fainting away in a trance. Breathing and all the bodily strength fail it. The soul is dissolved into that of God, and with the union at last comes comprehension of the graces bestowed by Him. For many, the urge to believe in transcendental existence and immortality is overpowering. Transcendentalism, especially when reinforced by religious faith, is psychically full and rich. It feels somehow right. In comparison, empiricism seems sterile and inadequate. In the quest for ultimate meaning, the transcendentalist route is much easier to follow. That is why, even as empiricism is winning the mind, transcendentalism continues to win the heart. Science has always defeated religious dogma point by point when the two have conflicted, but to no avail. In the United States, there are 15 million Southern Baptists, the largest denomination favoring literal interpretation of the Christian Bible, but only 5,000 members of the American Humanist Association, the leading organization devoted to secular and deistic humanism. Still, if history and science have taught us anything, it is that passion and desire are not the same as truth. The human mind evolved to believe in the gods. It did not evolve to believe in biology. Acceptance of the supernatural conveyed a great advantage throughout prehistory when the brain was evolving. Thus, it is in sharp contrast to biology, which was developed as a product of the modern age and is not underwritten by genetic algorithms. The uncomfortable truth is that the two beliefs are not factually compatible. As a result, those who hunger for both intellectual and religious truth will never acquire both in full measure. Meanwhile, theology tries to resolve the dilemma by evolving science-like toward abstraction. The gods of our ancestors were divine human beings. The Egyptians, as Herodotus noted, represented them as Egyptian, often with body parts of nilotic animals, and the Greeks represented them as Greeks. The great contribution of the Hebrews was to combine the entire pantheon into a single person, Yahweh, a patriarch appropriate to desert tribes, and to intellectualize his existence. No graven images were allowed. In the process, they rendered the divine presence less tangible. And so, in biblical accounts, it came to pass that no one, not even Moses approaching Yahweh in the burning bush, could look upon his face. In time, the Jews were prohibited even from pronouncing his true full name. Nevertheless, the idea of a theistic God, omniscient, omnipotent, and closely involved in human affairs, has persisted to the present day as the dominant religious image of Western culture. During the Enlightenment, a growing number of liberal Judeo-Christian theologians, wishing to accommodate theism to a more rationalist view of the material world, moved away from God as a literal person. Baruch Spinoza, the preeminent Jewish philosopher of the 17th century, visualized the deity as a transcendent substance present everywhere in the universe. Deus sive natura, God or nature, he declared, they are interchangeable. For his philosophical pains, he was banished from Amsterdam under a comprehensive anathema, combining all curses in the book. The risk of heresy notwithstanding, the depersonalization of God has continued steadily into the modern era. For Paul Tillich, one of the most influential Protestant theologians of the 20th century, the assertion of the existence of God as person is not false, it is just meaningless. Among many of the most liberal contemporary thinkers, the denial of a concrete divinity takes the form of process theology. Everything in this most extreme of ontologies is part of a seamless and endlessly complex web of unfolding relationships. God is manifest in everything. Scientists, the roving scouts of the empiricist movement, are not immune to the idea of God. Those who favor it often lean toward some form of process theology. They ask this question: when the real world of space, time, and matter is well enough known, will that knowledge reveal the Creator's presence? Their hopes are vested in the theoretical physicists who pursue the goal of the final theory, the theory of everything, TOE, a system of interlocking equations that describe all that can be learned of the forces of the physical universe. TOE is a beautiful theory, as Steven Weinberg has called it in his important essay, Dreams of a Final Theory. Beautiful because it will be elegant, expressing the possibility of unending complexity with minimal laws, and symmetric because it will hold invariant through all space and time, and inevitable, meaning that once stated, no part can be changed without invalidating the whole. All surviving subtheories can be fitted into it permanently, in the manner in which Einstein described his own contribution, the general theory of relativity. The chief attraction of the theory, Einstein said, lies in its logical completeness. If a single one of the conclusions drawn from it proves wrong, it must be given up, to modify it without destroying the whole structure seems to be impossible. The prospect of a final theory by the most mathematical of scientists might seem to signal the approach of a new religious awakening. Stephen Hawking, yielding to the temptation in A Brief History of Time, 1988, declared that this scientific achievement would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we would know the mind of God. Well, perhaps, but I doubt it. Physicists have already laid in place a large part of the final theory. We know the trajectory, we can see roughly where it is headed, but there will be no religious epiphany, at least none recognizable to the authors of Holy Scripture. Science has taken us very far from the personal God who once presided over Western civilization. It has done little to satisfy our instinctual hunger so poignantly expressed by the psalmist, "Man liveth his days like a shadow, and he disquieteth himself in vain with prideful delusions. His treasures he knoweth not who shall gather them. Now, Lord, what is my comfort? My hope is in thee." The essence of humanity's spiritual dilemma is that we evolved genetically to accept one truth and discovered another. Is there a way to erase the dilemma, to resolve the contradictions between the transcendentalist and empiricist worldviews? No, unfortunately there is not. Furthermore, a choice between them is unlikely to remain arbitrary forever. The assumptions underlying the two worldviews are being tested with increasing severity by cumulative, verifiable knowledge about how the universe works, from atom to brain to galaxy. In addition, the harsh lessons of history have made it clear that one code of ethics is not as good, at least not as durable, as another. The same is true of religions. Some cosmologies are factually less correct than others, and some ethical precepts are less workable. There is a biologically based human nature, and it is relevant to ethics and religion. The evidence shows that because of its influence, people can be readily educated to only a narrow range of ethical precepts. They flourish within certain belief systems and wither under others. We need to know exactly why. To that end, I will be so presumptuous as to suggest how the conflict between the worldviews will most likely be settled. The idea of a genetic evolutionary origin of moral and religious beliefs will be tested by the continuance of biological studies of complex human behavior. To the extent that the sensory and nervous systems appear to have evolved by natural selection, or at least some other purely material process, the empiricist interpretation will be supported. It will be further supported by verification of gene-culture coevolution, the essential linking process described in earlier chapters. Now, consider the alternative. To the extent that ethical and religious phenomena do not appear to have evolved in a manner congenial to biology, and especially to the extent that such complex behavior cannot be linked to physical events in the sensory and nervous systems, the empiricist position will have to be abandoned and a transcendentalist explanation accepted. For centuries, the writ of empiricism has been spreading into the ancient domain of transcendentalist belief, slowly at the start, but quickening in the scientific age. The spirits our ancestors knew intimately first fled the rocks and trees, then the distant mountains. Now they are in the stars, where their final extinction is possible. But we cannot live without them. People need a sacred narrative. They must have a sense of larger purpose in one form or other, however intellectualized. They will refuse to yield to the despair of animal mortality. They will continue to plead in company with the psalmist, "Now, Lord, what is my comfort?" They will find a way to keep the ancestral spirits alive. If the sacred narrative cannot be in the form of a religious cosmology, it will be taken from the material history of the universe and the human species. That trend is in no way debasing. The true evolutionary epic, retold as poetry, is as intrinsically ennobling as any religious epic. Material reality discovered by science already possesses more content and grandeur than all religious cosmologies combined. The continuity of the human line has been traced through a period of deep history 1,000 times older than that conceived by the Western religions. Its study has brought new revelations of great moral importance. It has made us realize that Homo sapiens is far more than a congeries of tribes and races. We are a single gene pool from which individuals are drawn in each generation and into which they are dissolved the next generation, forever united as a species by heritage and a common future. Such are the conceptions based on fact from which new intimations of immortality can be drawn and a new mythos evolved. Which worldview prevails, religious transcendentalism or scientific empiricism, will make a great difference in the way humanity claims the future. During the time the matter is under advisement, an accommodation can be reached if the following overriding facts are realized. On the one side, ethics and religion are still too complex for present-day science to explain in depth. On the other, they are far more a product of autonomous evolution than hitherto conceded by most theologians. Science faces, in ethics and religion, its most interesting and possibly humbling challenge, while religion must somehow find the way to incorporate the discoveries of science in order to retain credibility. Religion will possess strength to the extent that it codifies and puts into enduring, poetic form the highest values of humanity consistent with empirical knowledge. That is the only way to provide compelling moral leadership. Blind faith, no matter how passionately expressed, will not suffice. Science, for its part, will test relentlessly every assumption about the human condition and, in time, uncover the bedrock of the moral and religious sentiments. The eventual result of the competition between the two worldviews, I believe, will be the secularization of the human epic and of religion itself. However the process plays out, it demands open discussion and unwavering intellectual rigor in an atmosphere of mutual respect. Chapter 12. To what end? It is the custom of scholars when addressing behavior and culture to speak variously of anthropological explanations, psychological explanations, biological explanations, and other explanations appropriate to the perspectives of individual disciplines. I have argued that there is intrinsically only one class of explanation. It traverses the scales of space, time, and complexity to unite the disparate facts of the disciplines by consilience, the perception of a seamless web of cause and effect. For centuries, consilience has been the mother's milk of the natural sciences. Now, it is wholly accepted by the brain sciences and evolutionary biology, the disciplines best poised to serve, in turn, as bridges to the social sciences and humanities. There is abundant evidence to support, and none absolutely to refute, the proposition that consilient explanations are congenial to the entirety of the great branches of learning. The central idea of the consilience worldview is that all tangible phenomena, from the birth of stars to the workings of social institutions, are based on material processes that are ultimately reducible, however long and tortuous the sequences, to the laws of physics. In support of this idea is the conclusion of biologists that humanity is kin to all other life forms by common descent. We share, essentially, the same DNA genetic code, which is transcribed into RNA and translated into proteins with the same amino acids. Our anatomy places us among the old world monkeys and apes. The fossil record shows our immediate ancestor to be either Homo ergaster or Homo erectus. It suggests that the point of our origin was Africa about 200,000 years ago. Our hereditary human nature, which evolved during hundreds of millennia before and afterward, still profoundly affects the evolution of culture. These considerations do not devalue the determining role of chance in history. Small accidents can have big consequences. The character of individual leaders can mean the difference between war and peace. One technological invention can change an economy. The main thrust of the consilience worldview, instead, is that culture, and hence the unique qualities of the human species, will make complete sense only when linked in causal explanation to the natural sciences. Biology, in particular, is the most proximate and hence relevant of the scientific disciplines. I know that such reductionism is not popular outside the natural sciences. To many scholars in the social sciences and humanities, it is a vampire in the sacristy. So let me hasten to dispel the profane image that causes this reaction. As the century closes, the focus of the natural sciences has begun to shift away from the search for new fundamental laws and toward new kinds of synthesis, holism, if you prefer, in order to understand complex systems. That is the goal, variously, in studies of the origin of the universe, the history of climate, the functioning of cells, the assembly of ecosystems, and the physical basis of mind. The strategy that works best in these enterprises is the construction of coherent cause-and-effect explanations across levels of organization. Thus, the cell biologist looks inward and downward to ensembles of molecules, and the cognitive psychologist to patterns of aggregate nerve cell activity. Accidents, when they happen, are rendered understandable. No compelling reason has ever been offered why the same strategy should not work to unite the natural sciences with the social sciences and humanities. The difference between the two domains is in the magnitude of the problem, not the principles needed for its solution. The human condition is the most important frontier of the natural sciences. Conversely, the material world exposed by the natural sciences is the most important frontier of the social sciences and humanities. The consilience argument can be distilled as follows. The two frontiers are the same. The map of the material world, including human mental activity, can be thought a sprinkling of charted terrain separated by blank expanses that are of unknown extent, yet accessible to coherent interdisciplinary research. Much of what I have offered in earlier chapters has been gap analysis, a sketch of the position of the blank spaces, and an account of the efforts of scholars to explore them. The gaps of greatest potential include the final unification of physics, the reconstruction of living cells, the assembly of ecosystems, the coevolution of genes and culture, the physical basis of mind, and the deep origins of ethics and religion. If the consilience worldview is correct, the traverse of the gaps will be a Magellanic voyage that eventually encircles the whole of reality. but that view could be wrong. The exploration may be proceeding across an endless sea. The current pace is such that we may find out which of the two images is correct within a few decades. But even if the journey is Magellanic, and even if the boldest excursions of circumscription consequently taper off so that the broad outline of material existence is well defined, we will still have mastered only an infinitesimal fraction of the internal detail. Exploration will go on in a profusion of scholarly disciplines. There are also the arts, which embrace not only all physically possible worlds, but also all conceivable worlds, innately interesting and congenial to the nervous system, and thus, in the uniquely human sense, true. Placed in this broader context of existence coherent enough to be understood in a single system of explanation, yet still largely unexplored, the ambitions of the natural sciences might be viewed in a more favorable light by non-scientists. Nowadays, as polls have repeatedly shown, most people, at least in the United States, respect science but are baffled by it. They don't understand it. They prefer science fiction. They take fantasy and pseudoscience like stimulants to jolt their cerebral pleasure centers. We are still Paleolithic thrill seekers, preferring Jurassic Park to the Jurassic era, and UFOs to astrophysics. The productions of science, other than medical breakthroughs and the sporadic thrills of space exploration, are thought marginal. What really matters to humanity, a primate species well adapted to Darwinian fundamentals in body and soul, are sex, family, work, security, personal expression, entertainment, and spiritual fulfillment, in no particular order. Most people believe, I am sure erroneously, that science has little to do with any of these preoccupations. They assume that the social sciences and humanities are independent of the natural sciences and more relevant endeavors. Who outside the technically possessed really needs to define a chromosome or understand chaos theory? Science, however, is not marginal. Like art, it is a universal possession of humanity, and scientific knowledge has become a vital part of our species' repertory. It comprises what we know of the material world with reasonable certainty. If the natural sciences can be successfully united with the social sciences and humanities, the liberal arts in higher education will be revitalized. Even the attempt to accomplish that much is a worthwhile goal. Profession-bent students should be helped to understand that in the 21st century, the world will not be run by those who possess mere information alone. Thanks to science and technology, access to factual knowledge of all kinds is rising exponentially while dropping in unit costs. It is destined to become global and democratic. Soon it will be available everywhere on television and computer screens. What then? The answer is clear. Synthesis. We are drowning in information while starving for wisdom. The world henceforth will be run by synthesizers, people able to put together the right information at the right time, think critically about it, and make important choices wisely. And this much about wisdom. In the long haul, civilized nations have come to judge one culture against another by a moral sense of the needs and aspirations of humanity as a whole. In thus globalizing the tribe, they attempt to formulate humankind's noblest and most enduring goals. The most important questions in this endeavor for the liberal arts are the meaning and purpose of all our idiosyncratic, frenetic activity. What are we? Where do we come from? How shall we decide where to go? Why the toil, yearning, honesty, aesthetics, exaltation, love, hate, deceit, brilliance, hubris, humility, shame, and stupidity that collectively define our species. Theology, which long claimed the subject for itself, has done badly. Still encumbered by precepts based on Iron Age folk knowledge, it is unable to assimilate the great sweep of the real world now open for examination. Western philosophy offers no promising substitute. Its involuted exercises and professional timidity have left modern culture bankrupt of meaning. The future of the liberal arts lies, therefore, in addressing the fundamental questions of human existence head-on, without embarrassment or fear, taking them from the top down in easily understood language, and progressively rearranging them into domains of inquiry that unite the best of science and the humanities at each level of organization in turn. That, of course, is a very difficult task, but so are cardiac surgery and building space vehicles difficult tasks. Competent people get on with them because they need to be done. Why should less be expected from the professionals responsible for education? The liberal arts will succeed to the extent that they are both solid in content and as coherent among themselves as the evidence allows. I find it hard to conceive of an adequate core curriculum in colleges and universities that avoids the cause and effect connections among the great branches of learning. Not metaphor, not the usual second-order lucubrations on why scholars of different disciplines think this or that, but material cause and effect. There lies the high adventure for later generations, often mourned as no longer available. There lies great opportunity. Granted, there is also a whiff of brimstone in the consilient worldview, and a seeming touch of Faust to those committed to its humanistic core. And these two need to be closely examined. What was it that Mephistopheles offered Faust, and how was the ambitious doctor to pay? From Christopher Marlowe's play to Goethe's epic poem, the bargain was essentially the same. Earthly power and pleasure in exchange for your soul. Then there were the differences. Marlowe's Faust was irrevocably damned when he made the wrong choice. Goethe's Faust was saved because he could not feel the happiness promised him through material gain. Marlowe upheld Protestant piety, Goethe, the ideals of humanism. In our perception of the human condition, we have moved beyond Marlowe and Goethe. Today, not one, but two Mephistophelian bargains can be distinguished. From them, as from the original, hard choices must be made. Both illustrate the value of considering the consilient vision. The first Faustian choice was actually made centuries ago, when humanity accepted the ratchet of progress. The more knowledge people acquire, the more they are able to increase their numbers and to alter the environment, whereupon the more they need new knowledge just to stay alive. In a human-dominated world, the natural environment steadily shrinks, offering correspondingly less and less per capita return in energy and resources. Advanced technology has become the ultimate prosthesis. Take away electric power from a tribe of Australian Aborigines, and little or nothing will happen. Take it away from residents of California, and millions will die. So, to understand why humanity has come to relate to the environment in this way is more than a rhetorical question. Greed demands an explanation. The ratchet should be constantly re-examined and new choices considered. The second Mephistophelian promise, generated by the first and strangely echoing the original Enlightenment, is due within a few decades. It says, "You may alter the biological nature of the human species in any direction you wish, or you may leave it alone. Either way, genetic evolution is about to become conscious and volitional, and usher in a new epoch in the history of life. Let us examine the two bargains, the second first for logical coherence, and consider the alternative fates they seem to imply. It is useful to know, before peering into the future, where we are now. Is genetic change still occurring in the old-fashioned way, or has civilization brought it to a halt? The question can be put more precisely as follows. Is natural selection still operating to drive evolution? Is it forcing our anatomy and behavior to change in some particular direction in response to survival and reproduction? The answer, like so many responses required in subjects of great complexity, is yes and no. To my knowledge, no evidence exists that the human genome is changing in any overall new direction. It may come immediately to your mind that the forces most afflicting humanity, including overpopulation, war, outbreaks of infectious disease, and environmental pollution, must somehow be pushing the species along in a directed manner. But these pressures have existed around the world for millennia, forcing the periodic decline of populations and even the destruction and replacement of entire peoples. Much of the adaptation expected to arise has probably already done so. Contemporary human genes are therefore likely to reflect the necessities these malign forces imposed in the past. We do not, for example, appear as a species to be acquiring genes for larger or smaller brains, more efficient kidneys, smaller teeth, greater or lesser compassion, or any other important adjustments in body and mind. The one undoubted global change is of lesser consequence. It is the shift occurring worldwide in the frequencies of racial traits such as skin color, hair type, lymphocyte proteins, and immunoglobulins due to more rapid population growth in developing countries. In 1950, 68% of the world's population lived in developing countries. By 2000, the figure will be 78%. That amount of change is having an effect on the frequencies of previously existing genes, but none of the traits involved, so far as we know, have world-shaping consequence. None affect intellectual capacity or the fundamentals of human nature. A few local quirks have been detected as well. There is, for example, brachycephalization. For the past 10,000 years, the heads of people have been growing rounder in populations as far apart as Europe, India, Polynesia, and North America. In rural Poland, between the Carpathian Mountains and the Baltic Sea, anthropologists have documented the trend in skeletons from around 1300 to the early 20th century, embracing about 30 generations. The change is due principally to the slightly higher survival rate of round heads, and not to the influx of brachycephalics from outside Poland. The trait has a partial genetic basis, but the reason for its greater Darwinian success, if any, remains unknown. Many hereditary divergences of local populations have been discovered in blood types, disease resistance, aerobic capacity, and the ability to digest milk and other foodstuffs. Most such differences can at least be tentatively linked to higher survival and reproduction in known conditions of the local environment. The frequency of adults able to digest milk, one of the most thoroughly studied traits, is highest in populations that have relied on dairying for many generations. Another local trend of adaptive nature was reported in 1994 by a group of Russian geneticists. Turkmen-speaking people from the hot deserts of Middle Asia, they discovered, produce more heat shock proteins in their skin fibroblasts, cells that form part of the loose connective tissue, than do people who have lived for many generations in nearby moderate climates. The difference, which is genetically based, confers higher rates of survival following severe heat stress. None of these regional trends appear to entail properties in anatomy or behavior of major consequence. Even the changes due to differential population growth are likely to prove short-lived if, as in present-day Thailand, birth rates in less developed countries drop to the levels prevailing in North America, Europe, and Japan. The big story in recent human evolution is not directional change, not natural selection at all, but homogenization through immigration and interbreeding. Populations have been in flux throughout history. Tribes and states have pressed into and around the territories of rivals, often absorbing these neighbors, occasionally extinguishing them altogether. The historical atlases of Europe and Asia, when their pages are flipped chronologically through 5 millennia, become film clips of changing ethnic boundaries. As we race forward from one decade to the next in the clips, chiefdoms and states spring into existence, expand like hungry two-dimensional amoebae, and vanish as others move in to take their place. The mixing sharply accelerated when Europeans conquered the New World and transported African slaves to its shores. Homogenization took a smaller leap in the 19th century with the European colonization of Australia and Africa. In more recent times, it has quickened yet again through the spread of industrialization and democracy, the two signature traits of modernity that render people restless and international borders porous. Most human populations remain differentiated on a geographical basis, and some ethnic enclaves will probably endure for centuries more, but the trend in the opposite direction is unmistakably strong. It is also irreversible. Homogenization is not dynamic on a global scale. It changes local populations, often swiftly, but cannot by itself consistently drive evolution of the human species as a whole in one direction or another. Its main consequence is the gradual erasure of previous racial differences, those statistical differences in hereditary traits that distinguish whole populations. It also increases the range of individual variation within the populations and across the entire species. Many more combinations of skin color, facial features, talents, and other traits influenced by genes are now arising than ever existed before. Yet the average differences between people in different localities around the world, not very great to start with, are narrowing. Genetic homogenization has similarities to the stirring together of liquid ingredients. The contents change dramatically, and many new kinds of products emerge at the level of gene combinations within individuals. Variance increases, the extremes are extended, new forms of hereditary genius and pathology are more likely to arise. But the most elemental units, the genes, remain unperturbed. They stay about the same in both kind and relative abundance. Continued over tens or hundreds of generations, the present rates of emigration and intermarriage could, in theory, eliminate all population differences around the world. People residing in Beijing might become statistically the same as those in Amsterdam or Lagos. But this is not the key issue of future genetic trends, because the rules under which evolution can occur are about to change dramatically and fundamentally. Thanks to advances of genetics and molecular biology underway, Hereditary change will soon depend less on natural selection than on social choice. Possessing exact knowledge of its own genes, collective humanity, in a few decades, can, if it wishes, select a new direction in its evolution and move there quickly. Or, if future generations prefer the free market of genetic diversity that existed in the past, they can choose simply to do nothing and live on their million-year-old heritage. The prospect of this volitional evolution, a species deciding what to do about its own heredity, will present the most profound intellectual and ethical choices humanity has ever faced. The dilemma, at its core, is far from science fantasy. Medical researchers, motivated by the need to understand the genetic basis of disease, have begun in earnest to map the 50,000 to 100,000 human genes. Reproductive biologists have cloned sheep, and presumably could do the same for human beings if the procedure were allowed. And thanks to the Human Genome Project, geneticists will be able to read off the complete sequence of our DNA letters, 3.6 billion in all, within one or two decades. Scientists are also experimenting with a limited form of molecular engineering, in which genes are altered in a desired direction by substituting snippets of DNA. Still another fast-moving enterprise in the biological sciences is the tracking of individual development from genes to protein synthesis, and thence to the final products of anatomy, physiology, and behavior. It is entirely possible that within 50 years we will understand in considerable detail not only our own heredity, but also a great deal about the way our genes interact with the environment to produce a human being. We can then tinker with the products at any level, change them temporarily without altering heredity, or change them permanently by mutating the genes and chromosomes. If these advances in knowledge are even just partly attained, which seems inevitable unless a great deal of genetic and medical research is halted in its tracks, and if they are made generally available, which is problematic, humanity will be positioned godlike to take control of its own ultimate fate. It can, if it chooses, alter not just the anatomy and intelligence of the species, but also the emotions and creative drive that compose the very core of human nature. The engineering of the genome will be the final of three periods that can be distinguished in the history of human evolution. During almost all of the 2 million year history of the genus Homo, culminating in Homo sapiens, people were unaware of the ultra-microscopic hereditary codes shaping them. In historical times, over the past 10,000 years, populations still experienced racial differentiation, largely in response to local climatic conditions, just as they had throughout the more distant past. During this passage through evolutionary time, shared with all other organisms, human populations were also subject to stabilizing selection. Gene mutants that caused disease or infertility were weeded out in each generation. These defective alleles were able to persist only when recessive in their expression, which means their effects could be overridden by the activity of dominant genes paired with them. Possession of two recessive genes, however, causes genetic disorders, as exemplified by cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs disease, and sickle cell anemia. Their double-dose carriers die young. Stabilizing selection, in this case through early death, continually sheds the genes from the population, making them mercifully rare. With the advent of modern medicine, human evolution has entered its second period. more and more of the hereditary defects can be deliberately moderated or averted, even when the genes themselves remain unaltered and present in double dose. Phenylketonuria, for example, until recent time, afflicted 1 out of 10,000 infants with severe mental retardation. Researchers discovered that the cause of phenylketonuria is a single recessive gene, which, in double dose, prevents normal metabolism of phenylalanine, a common amino acid. Abnormal metabolic products of the substance build up in the blood, causing brain damage. With this elementary fact in their reference books, physicians are now able to prevent the symptoms entirely by restricting phenylketonuric infants to phenylalanine-free diets. Examples like the circumvention of phenylketonuria are becoming common and will be multiplied many times over in the years immediately ahead. For the first time, people are using scientific knowledge to gain conscious control over their heredity, progressing one gene at a time. The evolutionary effect will be to relax stabilizing selection at an increasing rate and thereby increase the genetic variability of humanity as a whole. This second period, the suppression of stabilizing selection, is only beginning. Over many generations, the moderation of the effects of harmful genes could result in a substantial change in human heredity at the population level. The benefits accruing will have to be bought, of course, with a growing dependence on exacting and often expensive medical procedures. The age of gene circumvention is also the age of medical prosthesis. We should not, however, worry that such destabilizing of selection will go too far. The second period of human evolution is ephemeral. It will not last enough generations to have an important impact on heredity of the species as a whole, because the knowledge that made it possible has brought us swiftly to the brink of the third period, that of volitional evolution. If we understand what changes in the genes cause particular defects, down to the nucleotide letters of the DNA code, then, in principle, the defect can be permanently repaired. Geneticists are hard at work to make this feat, called gene therapy, a reality. They are hopeful that cystic fibrosis, to cite the most advanced current project, can be at least partly cured by introduction of unimpaired genes into the lung tissues of patients. Another class of defects that seem permanently treatable within a few years includes hemophilia, sickle cell anemia, and certain other inherited blood diseases. Progress in gene therapy has admittedly been slow in the early period, but it will accelerate. Too much hope is at stake, and too much venture capital poised to permit failure. Once established as a practical technology, gene therapy will become a commercial juggernaut. Thousands of genetic defects, many fatal, are already known. More are discovered each year. Each such gene is carried in single or double dose by thousands to millions of people around the world, and each individual person bears on average at least several different kinds of defective genes somewhere on his chromosomes. In most cases, the genes are recessive and loaded in single dose. But the carrier, even if he does not suffer the defect, risks having a child with a double dose and full-blown symptoms. It is obvious that when genetic repair becomes safe and affordable, the demand for it will grow swiftly. Sometime in the next century, that trend will lead into the full volitional period of evolution. The advance will create a new kind of ethical problem, which will be the Faustian decision of which I spoke. How much should people be allowed to mutate themselves and their descendants? Consider that your descendants, whom you may wish to alter in some beneficent manner, may well be my descendants also through intermarriage in the years ahead. With that in mind, can we ever agree on how much DNA tinkering is moral? In making such choices, there is an important line to be drawn between the remedy of clear-cut genetic defects on one side and the improvement of normal healthy traits on the other. The scientific imagination will think it but a small step from, say, severe dyslexia, one gene region discovered in 1994 on chromosome number 6, to mild dyslexia, and another short hop to unimpaired learning ability, and finally, one step more, to superior learning ability. I suffer from a mild form of dyslexia called visual sequencing disability, habitually reversing numbers. 8,652 too easily becomes 8,562, and struggling to grasp words spelled out to me letter by letter. I apologize and ask to see them in writing. I would certainly prefer not to suffer this minor but inconvenient debility. If it is genetic in origin, I would be pleased to learn instead that it had been fixed when I was an embryo. My parents, had they known and been able, would probably have agreed and taken care of the problem. Fair enough, but what about altering genes in order to enhance mathematical and verbal ability, to acquire perfect pitch, athletic talent, heterosexuality, adaptability to cyberspace? In a wholly different dimension, citizens of states and then of all humanity might choose to make themselves less variable in order to increase compatibility. Or the reverse. They might choose to diversify in talent and temperament, aiming for varied personal excellence, and thus the creation of communities of specialists able to work together at higher levels of productivity. Above all, they will certainly aim for greater longevity. If such engineering for long life proves even just partly successful, it will create vast social and economic dislocations. The present trajectory of science ensures that future generations will acquire the technical ability to make such choices. We are not in the volitional period yet, but we are close enough to make the prospect worth thinking about. Homo sapiens, the first truly free species, is about to decommission natural selection, the force that made us. There is no genetic destiny outside our free will, no lodestar provided by which we can set course. Evolution, including genetic progress in human nature and human capacity, will be, from now on, increasingly the domain of science and technology, tempered by ethics and political choice. We have reached this point down a long road of travail and self-deception. Soon, we must look deep within ourselves and decide what we wish to become. Our childhood having ended, we will hear the true voice of Mephistopheles. We will also come to understand the true meaning of conservatism. By that overworked and confusing term, I do not mean the pietistic and selfish libertarianism into which much of the American conservative movement has lately descended. I mean instead the ethic that cherishes and sustains the resources and proven best institutions of a community. In other words, true conservatism, an idea that can be applied to human nature as well as to social institutions. I predict that future generations will be genetically conservative. Other than the repair of disabling defects, they will resist hereditary change. They will do so in order to save the emotions and epigenetic rules of mental development, because these elements compose the physical soul of the species. The reasoning is as follows. Alter the emotions and epigenetic rules enough, and people might in some sense be better, but they would no longer be human. Neutralize the elements of human nature in favor of pure rationality, and the result would be badly constructed protein-based computers. Why should a species give up the defining core of its existence, built by millions of years of biological trial and error? What lifts this question above mere futurism is that it reveals so clearly our ignorance of the meaning of human existence in the first place, and illustrates how much more we need to know in order to decide the ultimate question: to what end or ends, if any in particular, should human genius direct itself? The problem of collective meaning and purpose is both urgent and immediate because, if for no other reason, it determines the environmental ethic. Few will doubt that humankind has created a planet-sized problem for itself. No one wished it so, but we are the first species to become a geophysical force, altering Earth's climate, a role previously reserved for tectonics, sun flares, and glacial cycles. We are also the greatest destroyer of life since the 10-kilometer-wide meteorite that landed near Yucatan and ended the age of reptiles 65 million years ago. Through overpopulation, we have put ourselves in danger of running out of food and water. So a very Faustian choice is upon us: whether to accept our corrosive and risky behavior as the unavoidable price of population and economic growth, or to take stock of ourselves and search for a new environmental ethic. That is the dilemma already implicit in current environmental debates. It springs from the clash of two opposing human self-images. The first is the naturalistic self-image, which holds that we are confined to a razor-thin biosphere within which 1,000 imaginable hells are possible, but only one paradise. What we idealize in nature and seek to recreate is the peculiar physical and biotic environment that cradled the human species. The human body and mind are precisely adapted to this world, notwithstanding its trials and dangers, and that is why we think it beautiful. In this respect, Homo sapiens conforms to a basic principle of organic evolution, that all species prefer and gravitate to the environment in which their genes were assembled. It is called habitat selection. There lies survival for humanity, and there lies mental peace, as prescribed by our genes. We are consequently unlikely ever to find any other place or conceive of any other home as beautiful as this blue planet was before we began to change it. The competing self-image, which also happens to be the guiding theme of Western civilization, is the exemptionalist view. In this conception, our species exists apart from the natural world and holds dominion over it. We are exempt from the iron laws of ecology that bind other species. Few limits on human expansion exist that our special status and ingenuity cannot overcome. We have been set free to modify Earth's surface to create a world better than the one our ancestors knew. For the committed exemptionalist, Homo sapiens has in effect become a new species, which I will now provide with a new name: Homo Proteus, or Shape-Changer Man. In the taxonomic classification of Earth's creatures, the diagnosis of hypothetical Homo Proteus is the following: cultural, indeterminately flexible, with vast potential, wired and information-driven, can travel almost anywhere, adapt to any environment, restless, getting crowded, thinking about the colonization of space, regrets the current loss of nature and all those vanishing species, but it's the price of progress and has little to do with our future anyway. Now, here is the naturalistic and, I believe, correct diagnosis of old Homo sapiens, our familiar wise man: cultural, with indeterminate intellectual potential, but biologically constrained, basically a primate species in body and emotional repertory, member of the order Primates, infraorder Catarrhinae, family Hominidae. Huge compared to other animals, Parvi hirsute, bipedal, porous, squishy, composed mostly of water, runs on millions of coordinated, delicate biochemical reactions, easily shut down by trace toxins and transit of pea-sized projectiles, short-lived, emotionally fragile, dependent in body and mind on other earthbound organisms. Colonization of space impossible without massive supply lines, starting to regret deeply the loss of nature and all those other species. The dream of man, freed from the natural environment of Earth, was tested against reality in the early 1990s with Biosphere 2, a 3.15-acre closed ecosystem built on desert terrain in Oracle, Arizona, paneled in glass, stocked with soil, air, water, plants, and animals. It was designed to be a miniature working Earth independent of the mother planet. The planners synthesized fragments of rainforest, savanna, thorn scrub, desert, pond, marsh, coral reef, and ocean to simulate the natural habitats of home. The only connections to the outside world were electrical power and communication, both reasonable concessions made for a primarily ecological experiment. The design and construction of Biosphere 2 cost $200 million. It incorporated the most advanced scientific knowledge and state-of-the-art engineering. Success of the experiment, if achieved, was expected to prove that human life can be independently sustained in hermetic bubbles anywhere in the solar system, not lethally seared by heat or hard radiation. On September 26, 1991, 8 volunteer Biospherians walked into the completed enclosure and sealed themselves off. For a while, everything went well. But then came a series of nasty surprises. After 5 months, the concentration of oxygen in Biosphere 2 began to drop from its original 21%, eventually reaching 14%, an amount that normally occurs at 17,500 feet, too low to sustain health. At this point, to keep the experiment going, oxygen was pumped in from the outside. During the same period, carbon dioxide levels rose sharply, despite the use of an artificial recycling procedure. Concentrations of nitrous oxide increased to levels dangerous to brain tissue. Species used to build the ecosystems were drastically affected. Many declined to extinction at an alarmingly high rate. 19 of the 25 vertebrates and all of the animal pollinators vanished. At the same time, a few species of cockroaches, katydids, and ants multiplied explosively. Morning glory, passion flower, and other vines, planted to serve as a carbon sink, grew so luxuriantly they threatened other plant species, including the crops, and had to be laboriously thinned by hand. The Biospherians coped heroically with these ordeals, managing to stay inside the enclosure the full 2 years originally planned. And as an experiment, Biosphere 2 was not at all a failure. It taught us many things, the most important of which is the vulnerability of our species and the living environment on which we depend. Two senior biologists who reviewed the data as part of an independent team, Joel E. Cohen of Rockefeller University and David Tillman of the University of Minnesota, wrote with feeling, "No one yet knows how to engineer systems that provide humans with the life-supporting services that natural ecosystems produce for free." And, despite its mysteries and hazards, Earth remains the only known home that can sustain life. In its neglect of the fragility of life, exemptionalism fails definitively. To move ahead as though scientific and entrepreneurial genius will solve each crisis arising in turn implies that the decline of the global biosphere can be similarly managed. Perhaps that might be possible in future decades. Centuries seem more likely. But the means are not yet in sight. The living world is too complicated to be kept as a garden on a planet that has been converted into an artificial space capsule. No biological homeostat is known that can be worked by humanity. To believe otherwise is to risk reducing Earth to a wasteland and humanity to a threatened species.